"Why, indeed," said Dr. Teal, raising an eyebrow. "We engineers should not be helping Quercus to put London on wheels. We should be advising him on how to lay the city out harmoniously on solid ground and surround it with the take-off stations for Arlo Thursday's air machines. Can you not take him under your protection? I know that Dr. Collihole would be fascinated by his discoveries." Dr. Teal winced. "Dr. Collihole?" "Fever. I should have told you. I completely forgot."
"What?"
"Dr. Collihole is dead."
"Dead? How?"
"I'm not sure. It happened shortly before I joined the Guild."
"But he was so well."
"They just found him dead one morning. It was a heart attack, I think.
I mean, he was old, but he was well."
"He was an old man. There are so many things that kill old men." A gust of wind blew spray from the fountain into Fever's face, and she was glad of it, because it gave her a chance to wipe her eyes before Dr. Teal could see that she was weeping. He put his hand on her shoulder, surprising her. Engineers did not usually touch one another. He said, "I'll have Hazel send word to London about the Thursday boy. If Flynn is after him, who knows? He may have stumbled upon something after all."
"He has," insisted Fever. It was frustrating. She knew that Dr. Teal still doubted her. He was blinded by the stories about Arlo Thursday being mad, but there was nothing more that she could say to convince him, and she knew that there was no point in dragging him back across the city with her to see Arlo Thursday's work for himself. Arlo would never let him in. Dr. Teal looked thoughtfully at her and said, "I'm pleased you decided not to go down to Merriam with your friends. I would have worried that I might lose you again. I have sent word north about you, you know. Master Hazel's courier should reach London in a day or two. Your mother and father will be relieved to hear that you are found."
"I was not lost," said Fever. It annoyed her that he had written to her parents. "I am not a child." "Clearly Ambrose Persimmon does not think so if he has let you remain here in Maida all alone," said Dr. Teal. He opened his book and studied his drawing of the big funicular. "Where are you lodging?"
"A hotel."
"You would be better off at Jonathan Hazel's place. I shall have him prepare a room for you."
"No," said Fever.
He looked up at that, surprised, perhaps a little angered.
"I am quite capable of looking after myself, Dr. Teal," Fever said.
She stood up.
"Please do not forget what I have told you about Arlo Thursday. Please send word to London quickly."
"Now hang on," the engineer started to say, but she'd already turned away. She strode back down the stairways toward Rua Penhasco and her hotel, wondering where she would eat that night, trying to forget the patronizing Dr. Teal and the sad news about Dr. Collihole, and regain that feeling of freedom and independence that she had felt earlier. The sun was low and red in the west now, and Maida was filling with shadows. In the busy street beside the harbour, a sedan chair pulled out in front of her, going in the same direction. She followed it, glad of the path it cut for her through the crowd, remembering how, in London, she had always thought sedan chairs a most unreasonable mode of transport. Here in Maida, with all these stairways, they made more sense. She guessed that this one was on its way to Barge Town, and wondered if its rich passengers would be disappointed to find the Lyceum gone. But suddenly, the two men carrying the chair set it down, blocking her way, and turned to meet her. One stuck out a beefy hand and seized her by the arm as she tried to step around him.
"Senorita Crumb!"
His friend opened the door of the chair. It was empty.
"Get in," said the first man. "Someone wants to meet you."
"Get off!"
Fever was struggling to free herself, but the man was immensely strong, as you'd expect of someone in his line of work, and she could not help noticing that there was a big knife stuck through his belt. She wondered if she should shout for help, but there was so much noise all around her that she didn't think anyone would hear. While she was trying to decide, the man pushed her at his friend, who shoved her inside the chair and closed the door. She tried to open it, but it was bolted. A sedan chair that could be locked from outside? Fever could not see the point of that, unless these bullocks made a habit of such abductions. Worried but uncertain what she could do to help herself, She sat down on the plush leather-covered seat and peeked out of the window as the bearers picked the chair up and hurried off with it. They were not heading for Bargetown, after all. Chapter 13. The Red Herring. The street called Rua Seculo ran all around Maida, about halfway up the crater wall, even spanning the harbour mouth on a vertiginous bridge. Some stretches of this street were smart and others shabby. The stretch where Fever's abductors finally set her down was on a boundary between the two. Fine mansions with sea views to the west, to the east long rows of run-down townhouses like rotting teeth. Between them a buttress of the cliff rose almost sheer, and 10 or more big funiculars had been built on it. Most of these were restaurants or nightclubs, and they shuttled ceaselessly up and down their tracks, entrancing their guests with an ever-changing view, filling the night air with the grumbling song of their wheels and cables. It was a restless part of town. The chair door opened, and the two men reached in to pull Fever out, grabbing an arm each. They did not hurt her, and to anyone watching it would have looked as if they were helping her. But their big, sturdy hands gripped like manacles, and she knew that there was no hope of escape. The chairman led her up some steps and along a pathway covered by a red awning to the door of one of the funiculars. It was a nightclub of some kind, she thought. 4 stories high, all wood, with painted carvings over the doors and ground-floor windows, the higher parts neglected, peeling. A sign shaped like a bright red fish was bolted to the wall high up on one corner, lit from within by gas. Across the portico was a name, The Red Herring. Fever guessed that the building was preparing to move up the cliff because she could hear the tanks beneath it emptying into some system beneath the street. People were queuing at the big front door, waiting to go in. Wealthy-looking couples, men in leopard print or shark-skin robes, their women much younger, with bright teeth and huge hair and gowns slit down the back and up the side. The chairman bustled her quickly past, the burly guards in the doorway ordering customers aside to make way. A young woman who had been standing just inside the club's big doors came out and smiled a large white smile at Fever and said, "You're expected." "By who?" asked Fever, but the woman just kept smiling and turned away. Fever's captors let go of her and gestured at her to follow the woman. She could think of nothing else to do. One of the men walked behind her as she went after the woman past an open inner door and up a long wind of stairs, the walls and the treads of the stairs all painted black, the reedy music of flutes and drums echoing from the low and flaking ceiling. They passed through another door at the top of the stairs into a tight, unhealthy-feeling warren of corridors somewhere at the back of the building. This place was a bit like the Lyceum, Fever thought. There must be a gaudy, spectacular-looking bit downstairs that the public saw, but all was clutter and confusion behind the scenes. The woman opened a door, looked in, said something that Fever didn't catch, then stood back and ushered Fever past her into a room with a big desk, a couple of chairs, stripes of red light coming through a blind on the window. A man sat writing at the desk, but he looked up when Fever entered and gestured with his angel quill pen toward an empty chair. Fever knew him. He was the same man who had watched her the previous night as she left Arlo Thursday's house. Midas Flynn. She recognised his deep-set eyes and that long bluish jaw. His hat was off, bearing a steep, domed head with 5 strands of black hair greased carefully across his scalp. "Miss Crumb," he said, still pointing with the quill. He had a high, breathy voice, a hard-to-place accent. Fever did not sit down. Behind her, the man who had helped to kidnap her fidgeted as he waited in the open doorway.
"Want me to stay?"
he asked.
"Thank you, Señor Vigo," said Midas Flynn. "I think I can manage. You may wait downstairs. Make sure nobody comes up."
The man grunted and turned away, closing the door with a soft click. Fever heard him say something to the woman as they walked off along the corridor.
"It is easy to hire thugs and assassins in Maida," said Midas Flynn casually, blinking his big eyes moistly at Fever. "There are whole guilds of them. The Shadow Men, for instance, who dedicate all their murders to the Mother Below, the Lords of Pain who specialize in torture, the songbirds who will murder or maim your enemy while singing him a message of your choice. Viggo and his friends are shadow men. I would not usually employ such violent fellows, but my business in Maida places me in a certain amount of danger, and their guild had a special offer on. They will protect me from anyone who might wish me harm. And if anyone does harm me, Senor Viggo and his chums will hunt down and kill them for no extra charge.
Was that a threat? Fever wondered, in case she was tempted to harm him herself with a little clasp-knife in her inner pocket.
You look afraid, said Midas Flynn. There's no reason to be.
I'm not, said Fever, although she was a little. Why did your man kidnap you?
I'm sorry for that. It was necessary. Please believe me, you are in no danger.
We need to talk, and it might be dangerous for you if you were seen speaking to me.
You could have just
invited you?
Midas Flynn seemed to have a nervous habit of finishing her questions for her.
You look far too sensible to accept invitations to cheap hotels from strangers, Miss Crumb.
Fever looked around the room. It seemed very ordinary. Shabby, like its occupant. There was a bed in one corner behind a curtain, clothes strewn on an armchair. The music from the club downstairs came up faintly through the floorboards.
Do you live here? No, I am in Maida on business, said Flynn. The rooms here are very reasonably priced, perhaps because of the noise. You were at Arlo Thursday's funicular this afternoon, I believe. Please, sit down.
Fever spread her coat skirts and sat down carefully on the chair's greasy edge. Midas Flynn blinked at her. Shifty, but not the murdering type, Dr. Teal had said. She hoped he had been right, as she watched Flynn's long hands go spidering across the desk to a carafe of blood-coloured Maiden wine. He filled two glasses and slid one toward Fever, who did not take it.
Now, Miss Crumb, he said, you must not think of me as your enemy. I am a scientist like you. I worked for many years on the secret of flight. Perhaps you have heard of the Flynn ornithopter, no? Well, that is not surprising. It never flew, and with every crash it took a little more of my money with it. But I am still determined to solve the problem. So I go hither and thither to speak with others working in the same field, and this past year I have started to find many of them dead.
Fever said, I know Edgar Saraband was
killed, yes.
He pronounced it killed.
Poor Saraband was just the latest victim.
Midas Flynn took a long drink of wine.
Before that, it was Ugo Carax, who hung himself in his studio, having burned all the plans for the dirigible balloon he had been working on. Most out of character. Before him, Caspar Delabole, crushed under his own experimental glider.
He paused, watching for Fever's reaction, as if wondering whether she had heard these names before. She hadn't, and he went on with his list, counting off dead aviators on his fingers.
Franz Kumdecker's motorized box kite broke up on its first flight. Mindy van der Waal's steam-powered triplane exploded in midair. Dr. Preston Collihole allegedly died of heart failure.
Dr. Collihole, said Fever, startled.
What do you mean, allegedly? Only that it seems rather an unlikely coincidence, don't you think?
Asked Flynn with a nervous smile.
So many philosophers all working on the same problem and all dying within a few months of one another.
Fever tried to come up with a reply, but all she could think of was Dr. Teal saying, there are so many things that kill old men. Frail as he was, it would have been simple for someone to murder Dr. Collihole and pretend his death was natural.
Somebody is killing them all, Miss Crumb, said Midas Flynn. Whenever a scientist starts to work on the problem of flight, this killer gets to hear of him and stretches out a hand right across Europa and snuffs him out. Who? Why? The why I do not know. As for who, I have only a name. Lothar Vishniak.
Fever tried to hide her little start of recognition, but he noted it and nodded.
Who he works for, I don't know, but I'm certain he was in Nice when Karax died, and in Thelona a few months ago, when young Saraband was killed. It would be a shame if Arlo Thursday turned out to be next on his list.
Why do you care? Asked Fever.
Because I believe that Thursday is on the right track. He's building an aeroplane, isn't he? Come, Miss Crumb. I know you talk to him. He will not open his gate to me. I can only keep watch on him from a distance, but you, you've been up to the house. I've seen you. He has shown you the machine, hasn't he?
He was leaning toward Fever, across the narrow desk, his eyes bulging slightly in his eagerness to know. She said nothing.
Miss Crumb, said Flynn, Vishniak is in Maida. I have seen him. Your friend Thursday must be made to understand how much danger he is in. I have tried. I have sent letters, posted notes, rung at his bell, but he takes no notice. He thinks I am a bad man, an enemy. But you, you talk to him. You must go and warn him. And you must take me with you. If I am with you, perhaps he will listen to me. Perhaps he will let me protect him and his invention.
That's what he's really after, Fever thought.
He doesn't care about Arlo at all. This story of murders he's spun me is probably all lies. Perhaps he's told the same lies to Arlo in his notes and letters, and that's where Arlo got the notion from. He's just after the machine. Maybe he invented Vishniak just to scare Arlo into sharing his secrets. Well, said Midas Flynn, still watching her.
His steep forehead was covered with beads of moisture, like warm cheese.
We can go now, tonight. This building will climb to the second level soon. It's not far from there to Casas Elevado. Will you introduce me to Senor Thursday, Miss Crumb? Will you vouch for me?
Fever wondered what she should say. She had no intention of taking him to Arlo, but if she told him that, he might become unpleasant. She was alone here at Flynn's mercy. Those hired thugs of his were still downstairs. It would be more rational to lie and pretend she would go along with him than find some way to escape once they were outside. But she hated lies and knew she was no good at telling them. She needed to calm herself and prepare. But it was impossible with Flynn's eager eyes fixed on her. She looked away. A door in the corner of the room stood ajar. She could hear water trickling in there, a toilet cistern filling. To buy time, she said,
May I use your...
Of course, said Midas Flynn.
I am a patient man, Miss Crumb, but we may not have much time.
His eyes followed her all the way to the door. She closed it behind her. The room she had stepped into was bigger than she'd expected. It contained not just a toilet, but a bath, too, left over from the days when the Red Herring had been some Maiden merchant's high-class villa. The bolt did not work. She closed the door and leaned against it, and wondered what to do. She went to the washbasin and stared at herself in the mirror, her face lit by the red glow of the big gaslit sign bolted to the wall outside the frosted window. Rain was patting at the glass. She wondered if it was raining in Meriem, too. The Lyceum would have to raise its awnings to keep the audience dry. The room lurched suddenly, as if it were a land barge going over rough ground. Midas Flynn's greyish toothbrush jiggled in a glass mug on the side of the bath. The Red Herring was on the move. Fever heard a bang from Flynn's office, a startled shout. She thought he had dropped something. But that seemed strange. He must be used to the club's movements. He had told her himself that it was about to set off, so it should not have caught him by surprise.
"Great gods!"
she heard him say, his voice sounding strange and muffled through the door, and then,
"Vishniak!"
A second bang, just like the first, the thud and scuffle of something heavy falling. She held her breath, standing there in the half-dark, in the blood-red glow from the window. The building quaked and rumbled as it was dragged up the cliffside. On the other side of the door, she could hear someone moving about, opening and closing drawers, dropping things. She bent down and peered through the keyhole, which showed her a corner of Flynn's desk and a swift glimpse of a wet, weatherproof cloak as someone walked past. It wasn't Flynn. She straightened up quickly, and the floor creaked under her heel. The movement outside stopped suddenly, and she knew that whoever it was out there had heard. In the next instant, there was another gunshot. A hole appeared in the bathroom door, and a tile shattered on the wall behind her, dust and splinters pattering to the floor. The bullet must have missed Fever by inches. She froze, made a statue of herself, not even moving her eyes, which stayed fixed on the hole in the door, on the rod of yellow light that poked through it from the room beyond. Footsteps came to the door. The hole darkened. She could hear someone breathing, just the other side of the thin wood. Slowly, silently, the doorknob began to turn. Fever waited until the door started to open, then stepped as noiselessly as she could into the angle behind it, flattening herself against the wall. Light came into the bathroom, and with it a silvery smell of gunpowder. A shadow fell across the chessboard tiles on the floor. Someone in a cloak and a hat. Someone with a pistol in his hand.
Vishniak, she thought.
The hand holding the pistol came into view around the edge of the door. A man's hand. The cuff of a wet sleeve. The pistol itself of northern workmanship. Blonde wood and steel, the long barrel decorated with a snarling wolf's head. She needed to breathe, and she dared not. If the gunman so much as touched the open door, it would press against her, and he would feel the resistance and know that she was there. If he took just another step into the bathroom... The cistern trickled again. A long trill of falling water, and then a series of single musical drips. The sound was a semitone higher than the noise the creaking floor had made. But to the man with the gun, it must have sounded the same. He let out a sigh that was half a snort, turned and was gone. Fever waited until she heard the outer door close before she let her own breath out. The moving building rumbled on. The toothbrush jiggled. When she went back into the main room, she could not see Midas Flynn at first. Then she spotted his feet poking out from behind the desk, tangled with the fallen chair. The patterns of hobnails on the soles of his boots glinted in the red light from the window, like the eyes of spiders. Fever stood in the bathroom doorway and watched the boots. They didn't move. She listened and heard the whisper of the rain, the drip of the cistern, her own raggedy breathing. Chapter 14. Buildings in Motion.
"Master Flynn,"
she said cautiously. She didn't expect an answer, and she didn't get one. She went to the desk and looked over into the narrow gap between the desk and the wall. Midas Flynn was lying there, and the carpet under him glistened wetly in the red light. He was dead. You could tell he was dead because of the expressionless way his eyes watched the ceiling, and because of the two big holes in the front of his tunic. There was blood on the wall, too, and on the desk, which Fever didn't notice until she put her hand down in it. It was thick and slightly warm. One of the drawers of the desk was half open, and she could see the handle of a gun in there. She pulled it out, wondering if it was loaded, remembering how she had loaded Kit Solent's pistols for him in that sedan chair back in London.
"Midas!"
said a voice, the door opening. She looked around. The girl who had shown her up was coming into the room, a faint frown between her perfect eyebrows. Fever held up a hand to halt her. The girl stared at it, stared at the blood on it, at the pistol in Fever's other hand, stared at the splashes on the wall, stared at Midas Flynn's dead leg sticking out from behind the desk. "He's been shot," said Fever. The girl started to scream. It was a shrill, awful sound, like a klaxon, and Fever started to go toward her, wondering how to make her stop. But the girl backed away from her and slammed the door on her way out. "No!" shouted Fever, dropping the pistol and running to the door. But by the time she opened it, the corridor outside was empty. She could hear the girl running away from her down the stairs, her fading shrieks mingling with the distant music. In a few moments, she would be back, probably bringing Flynn's hired thugs. They'd hear the girl's story, and they'd come up here and find her, and find Flynn dead, and there'd be nothing she could tell them that would make them believe she wasn't the killer. She imagined trying to reason with them, but she knew too well that when people get panicky, reason is the first thing they abandon. They'd probably shoot her before she could get two words out. How had Vishniac come in and out without them seeing him, she wondered. He must have found a way in over the roof. That gave her an idea. She went back into the room and closed the door, turning the key in the lock. She crossed the room and got in between the blind and the window to force the casement open. The night air smelled of rain and metal as she scrambled onto the shuddering, rain-slithery wooden window ledge. Above her a flaking cornice jutted out, spattered with the droppings of pigeons and angels. Raindrops fell from it and plunged past her, through the red light from the fish-shaped sign and down into the steep, ragged strip of cliff garden that separated the red herring from the rails of its counterweight. The rails glistened wetly in the light from the club. Fever looked up the slope and saw the counterweight coming down, a big white restaurant stately as a ship. Beyond it, all along the cliffside, buildings were going up or coming down, lights gleaming through the rain. Back in the room, she could hear fists pounding on the door and muffled voices shouting at her to open it. She glanced up the line again. The counterweight restaurant was still 100 yards away, but it was quickly coming closer. She estimated the red herring's speed to be a brisk walking pace, say 4 miles per hour. The counterweight must be moving at the same rate, which gave a combined speed of 8 miles per hour. They would both reach the track's halfway point at the same moment, and at that speed, they might take 20 seconds to pass each other. That should be time enough. The door burst open, and the room started filling with men. They carried knives and swords. One held a pistol. Fever peeked in at them through the streaming windows, watching between the slats of the blind. She saw the one called Vigo giving orders to the others. He pointed to the half-open door of the bathroom, and two of the others went in to check it. He stooped over Midas Flynn, and she saw him shake his head. Then he raised it and looked straight at her through the blind. She started to edge along the ledge. The wood was wet, slippery, rotten. A chunk fell off under her weight and dropped, turning over and over in the red light. She dug her nails into the wet boards of the wall to save herself from going with it. "There she is!" Vigo was leaning out of the window, pointing her out to another man, the one with the pistol, who stretched it out toward her, holding one hand over the firing mechanism to keep the rain off it. "It wasn't me!" she shouted. "There was someone else! Vishniac, I think!" "Don't give me that!" he shouted back. "You killed Flynn!" He was being as unreasonable as Fever had feared. She looked away from him. The descending restaurant was only a few yards uphill now, but it was veering away from her. In the spell of light from its verandas, she saw that the rails curved here to allow the two buildings to pass each other with a few yards to spare. Could she jump those few yards? There was a flash and a hissy bang, and the pistol ball sang past her nose and thudded into the cornice above her, spraying her with scales of old paint and splinters of rotted wood. She looked around. The gunman was already reloading, while one of his mates scrambled warily out onto the ledge with a knife in his hand. It was either jump or die. The restaurant was passing, filling the air with noise, splashing pale light up the walls of the red herring. There was only one rational choice. Desperate and ungainly, flapping her long limbs as if she were trying to fly, she flung herself across the yawning space between the buildings, caught a whirling glimpse of the canyon between them, the lighted windows and the falling rain. Then she slammed against roof tiles and slithered down, grabbing for a handhold, gasping, fetching up in a guttering. A pistol ball shattered a tile a few feet away. She turned her head and saw the red herring go grinding past, the shadow man watching her furiously from the window of Flynn's room. Just before it parted from its counterweight, two of them made the same leap Fever had. She heard them land with thumps and grunts and curses a little farther along the roof. A second before they landed, she had felt as if she'd never move again. A second afterward, she was up and running, knowing that her only hope was to outpace them. The restaurant roof formed a strange landscape, steep hillocks tiled with green copper dragon scales, flat plains of asphalt where the rain had pooled. She splashed through the puddles, hearing shouts and heavy footfalls behind her. Chimney stacks towered up around her. Ventilators with visored cowls like the helms of evil knights exhaled smells of cooking from the kitchens below. Twice she scared up roosting angels, flinching from the applause of their wings as they took off into the rain. Then she was at the far side of the restaurant, and a neighbouring building was climbing past it, and she hesitated on a sagging corner of the roof, and heard the shadow men come blundering across the tiles toward her, and threw herself forward just as the first of them reached for her. This time the distance was even greater, and she almost missed. Her hands caught hold of a guttering that tilted and nearly gave way, drenching her in dirty water. Dangling there, she looked back. And there were her two pursuers, standing uselessly between the restaurant's chimneys as it carried them down to Rua Seculo. Fever's hands slipped on the wet lead of the guttering. She screamed, fell, landed with a jarring thump on the pierced metal landing of a fire escape that switched back down the wall below her. There she lay, listening to the sounds of music and laughter from inside, letting the building take her with it as it glided up the cliff. By the time it reached its railhead, she had managed to stop herself trembling. She pulled herself upright, brushed the dirt from her clothes, and went down the metal stairs to mingle with some raucous customers who were spilling out of the building's exits into one of the labyrinths of little streets near the top of the southern stair. She turned downhill, feeling immensely tired and wanting nothing more than to be in her neat little bed in her neat little room at the hotel. But after she had gone a few yards, she stopped. Vishniak would have left the red herring by now, unnoticed amid the confusion. And if Flynn had been right, he would be making for Casas Elevado. He might be there already. She shivered, recalling the sound of his breathing, the shadow he'd thrown on the floor of Flynn's bathroom. Lothar Vishniak. Even his name sounded scary. The locks on Arlo's gate would not stop a man like that. She went a few more steps, thinking that she must go and find Dr. Teal. But Dr. Teal was on the far side of Maida. It might take her an hour to reach and rouse him. Maybe fat Jargo Belkin and his beautiful wife could help her, but she didn't even know where their home was. She looked about for someone she could ask for help, but these streets were rough and disreputable. She saw only drunk sailors shambling from bar to bar and irrationally dressed women calling down to them from balconies. In an alleyway, a man was being kicked and beaten by a quartet of brawny thugs in straw hats and stripy coats who were singing, "That's for squealing on Louis, you double-crossing fink," in a catchy four-part harmony. Realizing that no one would help her but herself, she turned back up the hill, running as fast as she could toward Casas Elevado. Chapter 15. At the Thursday House. Casas Elevado was almost deserted in the dark, and the few passers-by there were hurrying along with their heads down against the strengthening rain. No one seemed to notice Fever as she ran to Arlo Thursday's gate. No one even glanced up when the gate swung slackly open at her touch, and she cried out. She stood there, in the shelter of the gateway, with the warm rain hissing on the road behind her, and rattling on the wet leaves of the garden in front of her, and the gate with its broken lock swinging wider, squeaking on its rusty hinges. She was too late. Vishniak had beaten her here, or else he'd come here before he called in on Midas Flynn. She stepped through the gate and went a little way along the path between the trees. The house was right up at the top of the gardens, no lights in its windows. Among the bushes in the garden something rustled, scaring her. But at her answering movement, it took sudden flight, white wings between the wet boughs, and she saw that it was just an angel. She started to climb without really knowing why. For all she knew, Vishniak was up there, and she did not imagine him to be the type of man who liked being disturbed when he was working. But she had to know whether Arlo Thursday was alive or dead. Alive seemed unlikely, given the broken gate and what had befallen Midas Flynn. But dead seemed impossible. All his ideas, all his knowledge, gone. Maybe if she was quick and careful, she might be able to salvage something, his notes or one of his models. A long flight of concrete steps ran straight up the middle of the garden, between the tracks for the house and the tracks for its counterweight. Viva supposed they had been put there so that the tracks could be maintained, and maybe as a means of escape, in case the house stuck halfway down. She went up them, breathless, her thighs aching with each step, looking up all the time at the house. Nothing moved there, no lights showed. She reached the top of the stairs and stepped onto the veranda, walking around to the back of the house where she had first met Arlo. The air was full of the smell of crushed herbs, lavender, lemongrass. The models that had hung from the veranda roof were gone. But that might not mean anything. Arlo might have taken them in because of the rain. Viva tried the back door. It was unlocked. She opened it a crack, but dared not go in. She put her face to the kitchen window and peered hard. Things inside looked much as they had that afternoon. She tried to imagine that Arlo Thursday was asleep behind the drawn blinds in one of those other rooms, or ignoring her the way he had before, not dead on the floor somewhere like Midas Flynn. She knew that it was stupidly dangerous to go into the house. What if Vishniak was inside? What if he had seen her light as she climbed the stairs? What if he was waiting for her? She couldn't prove that he was not, but she had no evidence that he was. She waited for a while, and there was no sound from inside the house. "Señor Thursday," she called softly at last. "Arlo, it's Fever Crumb." Echoes of her voice came flatly back at her, off the wet cliffs at the top of the garden. That was all the answer she got. She opened the door wider and stepped through, went past the empty kitchen, padding along the hall with her breath held, her eyes adjusting to the dark. Rain rattled at the windows and a guttering somewhere dripped steadily. In the doorway of the former dining room, the sawdust and wood shavings made pale patterns on the floor. She pushed open the door. The room was empty. The flying machine was gone. Even the battered table was bare, cleared of tools and drawings, as well as the Saraband engine. If it were not for the dust and the shavings, Fever could have believed the machine had been nothing but a dream. She moved on through the house, afraid of what she expected to find. But all she found were empty rooms, most barely furnished. What furniture there was, tiger-striped by the dim, rainy light that pierced the window blinds. In the bedroom, something lay on the floor. But when she fumbled her flashlight out and switched it on, it revealed only a heap of Arlo Thursday's clothes. She swung the flashlight beam onto the wall behind the bed. A painting hung there in a driftwood frame. It was the sort of painting that proud Maiden shipowners commissioned to mark the launching of a new vessel. Two young men in the clothes of half a century ago, standing on a quayside with an elegant ship behind them. The man on the right was black-haired, and his freckled face was so like Arlo's that it seemed logical to assume that he was Arlo's grandfather, the notorious Daniel Thursday. But the other... Fever went closer, kicking aside the drift of abandoned clothes without noticing them as she stared at the double portrait. Staring at a confident-looking man with a long jaw, grey eyes, set slightly wider apart than the eyes of Homo sapiens. a lion's mane of dark gold hair. Over his cheekbones, across his brow, were clusters of dark markings, like messages scribbled in an unknown alphabet. The artist had captured something arrogant and playful in his smile. She knew that smile, that face, that noble head. She ought to. She'd lived inside a statue of it for 14 years. She wished she still had hold of God's Hawk's memories. That way she might have been able to understand what the scriven superbrain and sometime King of London had been doing in Maida 50 years ago, posing for his portrait with a Maiden shipwright. As it was, she could only make a guess, based on the tale she'd heard at supper the other night. The stranger from the north who had befriended Daniel Thursday. "What did you give him for the ship he built you, Grandfather? Was it you who taught him those Navier-Stokes equations? Helped him become Maida's finest shipwright?" Her eyes switched their focus, some instinct in her sensing movement long before her conscious brain. When God's Hawk posed for that portrait all those years ago, he had chosen to wear a dark plum-coloured tunic. That dark portion of the picture with the glass over it made a passable mirror, and reflected in it, just above his breast pocket, she saw her own long face, with its echoes of his, and the candlelight reflecting in her eyes. And also in the eyes of someone else who was creeping into the room behind her. She spun around, ready to run, but there was nowhere to run to. The man, who must have entered the house silently while she was searching it, barred the doorway. She thought at first that he was Vishniak, then that he must be one of Flynn's men who had followed her up here. But he was a stranger, a big man wearing a sleeveless leather tunic. An octopus tattooed on his bicep seemed to flex its tentacles as he strode quickly toward her and put an arm around her neck. There was a knife in his other hand, which he lifted up for her to see. Light from her dropped flashlight rolled down its blade like liquid. "Come," he said. And she went, numbly, without trying to argue, tripping over her own feet in her hurry to keep up while he walked her out of the house with his thick arm still locked around her throat. There was another man on the veranda, another sleeveless tunic, another octopus tattoo. Who were they? They didn't speak, but marched back down the stairs with Fever between them. At the bottom, in the shadow of the trees, a third man waited, pacing to and fro with a lantern. When they drew near, she saw with immense relief that he was Jago Belkin, and realized that these other two must be his servants. If she had any gods, she would have thanked them. She could not guess what had brought fat Jago there, but she was glad to see his round, amiable face.
"Thursday's cleared out," said one of the men. "There was just the girl."
Fat Jago looked at Fever. She thought he would tell the man to let her go, but all he said was,
"You know where he is?"
Fever shook her head. The man holding her said,
"Don't reckon she does, Fat Jago. She was calling his name like she was looking for him."
Fat Jago sighed. He handed the lantern to one of the men. Rain had beaded on the red diamond of makeup on the top of his head.
"You're a difficult young woman, Miss Crumb," he said. "Didn't I tell you not to come here again? Didn't I tell you it was dangerous? Yet you were here this afternoon, and now you're back again."
"Arlo's gone," said Fever, trying to twist herself free of the man's arm. "Vishniak's here. He killed Midas Flynn. You've got to—"
Fat Jago slapped her suddenly across the face so hard that her head jerked sideways and she bit her tongue. She was so shocked that for a moment she couldn't breathe. She tasted blood, thought, "He's not here to help at all. He's here for something else." She could guess what it was. Like Midas Flynn, the fat man was after Arlo's aeroplane.
"So, Flynn's dead," he said. "Well, he was a loser. I didn't care if Flynn was poking about. You're different. Thursday talked to you. Don't deny it. I've had my own people watching this place. Who are you working for? The Londoner, is it? Dr. Teal? He set you to win Thursday's trust, did he?"
"I'm not working for anyone," said Fever.
Her voice sounded tiny and trembly. She was very afraid that Fat Jaga would hit her again. She said,
"Please listen. There's a man called Vishniak. Midas Flynn said that he's killing everyone who tries to fly. And then he killed Flynn. And I came here to warn Arlo."
"Or to kill him yourself and steal his secrets," said the fat man. "I've heard about this Vishniak. You know what I think? I don't believe there's any such person. Vishniak doesn't exist. He's nothing but a bogeyman, a scare story. But you're real enough. And so's your boss, that engineer."
"Dr. Teal's only here to study the funiculars," said Fever, wishing there was something she could say that would turn him back into the friendly, jovial Jargo she had known before. "And I don't work for him anyway. I work at Master Persimmon's theatre."
"But the theatre's gone, and you're still here. And so is Dr. Teal." Fat Jargo grinned. "So, London wants the Thursday machine as well. And I'd thought they were too busy sticking wheels on their city. Where is Thursday?"
"I don't know."
He considered her.
"No, I don't believe you. But I'll find him."
His eyes went up and down her.
"It's a pity. Thetza had taken a fancy to you.
She was looking forward to you coming for lunch tomorrow. Now I'll have to tell her you can't make it after all."
The man holding Fever moved his knife. It splashed reflections of the lantern into her eyes.
"What are we going to do with her, Fat Jago?" he asked.
Fat Jago held up a hand, shook his head. His eyes lingered thoughtfully on Fever for a moment.
"Nothing crude," he decided. "Something theatrical. Something to show her London masters what happens to people who pick a fight with Fat Jago Belkin."
Chapter 16. Mobile Home. So they took her a little way back up the steps, and one man tied her tightly across one of the rails while his comrade hurried on up to the house. The rain was heavy now. Jago Belkin held an umbrella over his bald head while he watched his men tug the knots tight on Fever's wrists and ankles and gag her with a grimy handkerchief. Fever thought about his adorable wife and wondered if she knew that he got up to this sort of thing. Probably not, she decided. Probably he kept this life quite separate from the other one, the one where he enjoyed the theatre and invited actors out to dinner.
"Well, Miss Crumb," he said, when she was securely bound, "you'll appreciate that I can't hang around here to watch the show. I'm a busy man, and you've already taken up too much of my time as it is. But don't worry, I'll leave Martino and Splint to keep an eye on you."
He gave her a friendly little wave and went away. Soon afterward, Fever felt the rails start to vibrate, and she knew that the man who had gone up the steps had operated the house's controls, and that it was beginning its descent. She started to struggle then, although reason told her that it was useless. The cords on her wrists and ankles were tied so tight that they were cutting into her flesh. She gave a few sobbing screams, but they were muffled by the gag. The man who had set the house moving came running back down the steps to join his friend, and they sat down side by side and took swigs from a flask that they passed between them while they watched her. They kept chuckling, and after a while she realized that they were enjoying her struggles. So she stopped and lay still. If she turned her head, she could see the greasy cable moving down in the shadowy gully between the rails. If she turned it the other way, she could see the house coming down at her.
"She's fainted, Splint," said one of the men. "No, she's just resting," said the other. "She'll wriggle hard enough when that house goes over her."
They were mocking her. They had to shout to make themselves heard, because by that time the counterweight was trundling past, wheels grating and squealing against its own set of rails as the weight of the descending house dragged it up the cliff. Fever did a quick calculation and worked out that she had 5 minutes left before the wheels of the house rolled over her. Except they wouldn't roll over her. They would roll through her. shearing her slowly in half. When she realized that, she started to struggle again, and this time she couldn't stop herself.
There you go, Martina, what did I tell you?
There was a scuffling sound, and a shrill, small voice close by her ear said,
Snacks, eh?
Twisting her head around, she got a face full of an angel's fishy breath. It was perching on the rail beside her, peering at her with its head on one side.
Snacks,
said the angel again, ever hopeful.
Help me,
said Fever through the gag.
Fetch help!
Snacks,
said the angel once more. Then one of the men on the steps threw a stone and a curse at it, and it spread its wings and heaved itself clumsily into the air.
Snaxes!
Fever heard it call, and a white splash of excitement broke on the rocks a few yards away. She listened to the wing beats till they faded, wondering if it had understood her, if it was flying to find help. Maybe the patrons of some mid-level taverna were listening to its garbled story even now and going, What's that, boy? Someone's in trouble? Up on the cliff? The rails were shuddering steadily now, and she could hear the mumble of metal on metal, the squeak of individual bearings in the house's undercarriage as it came closer. I'm going to die, she thought. But she couldn't seem to make it mean anything. She couldn't really believe that in a few minutes more she would be nothing. That was why people believed in gods and afterlives, she supposed, because it was so hard to imagine yourself just gone. But she was an engineer. She wasn't going to seek comfort in fairy tales and make-believe. Not even now. This here and now was all there was. So she had to use every last instant of it. She braced herself and strained against the cords and against the pain of the cords and screamed as loudly as she could behind the gag.
She is screaming again, said one of the men on the steps. I like it when they do that. It's satisfying. Gives you the feeling of a job well done.
Twisting her head around, Fever looked down the gleaming rails toward Casus Elevado, hoping to see some passerby who might have heard her muffled shout. There was nobody. She looked upward instead, but the other funiculars were perched peacefully at the tops of their tracks, and if any of the householders wondered why the Thursday house was trundling downhill in the middle of the night, they did not bother coming out to investigate. She was just readying herself to shout again, when she saw a movement, high above her, up where Arlo Thursday's garden petered out into scrub oak and scree and the steep blackness of the crags. Metal was glinting as something pushed through the bushes there. A man, she thought, at first, but then she wasn't sure. It emerged from the scrub and came crab-wise down the steep slope, past the descending house, moving quickly with a weird hopping motion. Crook-legged, headless, shiny as a gun. Her eyes must have widened in surprise.
What's she looking at? Asked Martino.
The other turned to see. He jumped up, pulling out his knife.
My Baggio,
Fever heard him mutter, as the thing came hopping into the pool of light cast by the lantern. And she still couldn't tell what it was. It was man-high and crab-shaped, and it had two legs, but the legs bent the wrong way, jagging up to sharp elbows above its moonshiny shell, then down to the flat, clawed feet that gripped the edge of the stairway. It looked as if someone had pulled six legs off a vast spider and given it armour in exchange. It had no face, but as it swung its gleaming body toward her, she saw a battery of small lamps at the front glint like eyes, and she felt sure that it had seen her.
"My Baggio,"
said the man with the knife again. His voice rose suddenly to a scream.
"Arahania!"
There was a sudden flickering of winter light beneath the thing's body and a rapid stuttering noise, like someone ripping a page out of a spiral-bound notebook. The knife came out of the man's hand. He somersaulted backward and went tumbling downhill. A smell of lavender burst over Fever as he slid past her through the shrubs. The lantern went out with a chink of smashed glass.
"Splint!" said the second man.
He started to stand up, too, and then stopped. Caught in a second fluttering of light and sound, he folded like a pocket knife and toppled into the gully between the rails. The thing lost interest in him. It turned toward the house, which was about 20 feet away. The light flared under its body again. But this time Fever couldn't hear the ripping sound, because it was drowned out by an immense rattling, as if hailstones were hammering against the metal wall of the tank under the veranda. The metal seemed to jolt and shimmer. It made a deep, unhappy, gonging noise, and suddenly the whole front of the tank gave way, and a whiteness burst from it that Fever did not quite realise was water, until it crashed coldly over her, and rushed around and past her, and went churning and gurgling away down the gully between the rails. She gasped and spluttered, drenched, half-drowned. Above her the funicular was starting to slow. "The tank is empty," she thought. "It's no heavier than the counterweight now. The drag of the counterweight will stop it." And sure enough, the house was shuddering, slipping, grumbling to a stop, so near to her that the light spilling down through the veranda planking from the kitchen windows striped her face. She looked at the steps again. The thing that had stood there was gone. It was the Aranya, she thought, and knew she must have imagined it, because the Aranya was only a demon in the story Belkin's wife had told at supper. But something had stopped the house coming down on her, and in the silence, as the last of the water trickled and dripped out of the ruined tank, she thought she could hear a faint sound fading among the moonlit shrubs. Tick, 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 tick. There seemed to be a pause then, a break in the night's momentum. Maybe she passed out for a few seconds. She had a dream, or a memory, very clear, of Fern and Ruin giggling at some silly joke on the Taverna Terrace the night before last. Only the night before last. Then she woke, regretting it, wishing she could stay unconscious. The rain had stopped. Through gaps in the scudding clouds she could see stars. Orion's Belt, and one of the minor moons, which some people claimed were really ancient satellites. Her wrists hurt. Someone was plucking at the wet cords that bound them. "Keep still," she heard a voice say. A blade shone in the light from the house windows. She wondered if this was another of Fat Jago's servants, but then he leaned over her, sawing at the cords, and she saw the freckles on his upside-down face and his long hair hanging down. "You shouldn't have come here," he said. "Arlo, I wanted to warn you. Lothar Vishniac is here, in Maida. He killed Midas Flynn. I thought he was coming for you too." Arlo grinned, dragging her away from the rails, and although Fever generally didn't like having anyone touch her, it felt pleasant to have his arms about her, like being a child again, lifted up after a tumble by some grown-up who was going to make everything better. "Do you think I didn't know that Vishniac's in town? I knew as soon as you brought me that glider. It's one of the ones I sent to Saraband. Vishniac must have brought it with him from Felona." "Then it was Vishniac who was up on the cliffs that night, throwing the glider so I'd see it. Why?" Arlo shrugged. Fever realised that she was pressed against him, enjoying the sea-grey smell of his damp clothes. She moved away and started smoothing her hair, trying to reclaim some of her dignity. "I thought Fat Jago would help me," she said shakily, trying to excuse the stupid predicament in which he had found her. "Fat Jago," Arlo laughed, which made her feel worse. "That's a good one. Don't you know who he is?" "No, who?" "He's part of the Octopus Cartel. They're a society of businessmen based in Matapan on the Middle Sea, and he looks after their interests here in Maida. You can guess what sort of business they're in. Slaving, mercenaries, smuggling, making profit out of other people's misery. I don't know how Fat Jago found out about my machine, but he wrote a few months back asking me to work for them. I refused, but it looks as if he didn't take my no for an answer." Every time he said Fat Jago, Fever shivered, remembering the way the rails had trembled under her as the house came downhill. She said, "Then they'll come back, won't they? What will you do?" "I'm moving out," said Arlo, watching her. "I know a place where I can finish the machine. It's already loaded aboard my boat. I was about to set sail when Weasel came and told me what was happening here. I couldn't just leave you to be squashed, could I?
The Aranya?
I sent it. It works for me. An old servant of my grandfather's. He stood up and reached down to help Fever to her feet. Come on.
Come on where? Where are we going?
You'll have to come with me. When fat Jargo Belkin finds out you're still alive, he'll want to kill you all over again. The Octopus Cartel doesn't...